So, Till We Have Faces, who wrote Till We Have Faces? Who wrote
this book?
C.S.
Lewis.
C.S. Lewis.
Is this the same person who wrote Narnia?
Yep, same guy. Mm-hmm. So, C.S. Lewis was a well-known Christian apologist. That didn't mean he said he was sorry for Christianity. That mean, what is being an apologist? What is that?
Apologist.
I just said it wasn't that. Huh? No.
Somebody
says apology. No. Apology. You're on the right track. Basically, he gives when you give an apology, you're not telling someone you're sorry. In the biblical sense, you're giving a defense for the faith. So when you make an apology, like in the biblical terms, like the word apologia, that's a Greek word that means like defense. So you're making a defense for the faith. That means if he defends the Christian faith against all other faiths. So C.S. Lewis was a well-known Christian apologist, and he was born in Northern Ireland, and he grew up in a house that was full of books. He grew up reading a lot. And he fought in World War I, and he was wounded in World War I. And eventually he became a teacher of language and literature at Oxford University. And we all heard of Oxford University in England. And then he became a professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge University. So these are well-known universities, and he has some really notable spots in there. So he was an atheist when he was younger, but he eventually became a Christian, and he used his talents in writing to propagate the faith, to defend the faith. And his writings have been really influential. We all know the Narnia series. He's written many, many books. What's another book, set of books? He's written the Space Trilogy. Yes?
What? Are we reading for Caspian, The Return of Narnia?
We're reading every Narnia book this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's right there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Reading all the Narnia books this year. They're all in that one volume.
Are you reading them now?
Are you going to read them in the order that they're supposed to be in, or the order they were published?
We're probably going to read them in the order they're supposed to be in. Chronological. I know. Pastor Joe would be livid right now over that. Yeah, that's okay. So anyhow, so he wrote Narnia, as we know. He wrote the Space Trilogy, so that's science fiction. But he also wrote Till We Have Faces. And this is, he admits this one is his favorite book, even though this is like the least known of his work. He's also written academic books in his academic fields of study. He's also written theological works, like Mere Christianity and The Problem of Pain and The Abolition of Man. He's written a lot of books. And many of these books came from the activity of a group of writers called the Inklings. You ever heard of those guys? Who else is in the Inklings? Very well-known authors. Tolkien and Dorothy Sayers is in the Inklings, too. Mm-hmm. He's the writer of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. She wrote the mystery novel that we read last year, and she wrote a lot of other things too. So yeah, huh? The Nine Tailors. That's right. Mm-hmm. So in this book, Till We Have Faces, it demonstrates this complex idea that Lewis was working on throughout his whole life, and the book is basically a retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche, which was written down in the ancient world by a poet named Apuleius. And Lewis's rendition of the story does something that many of the other retellings don't do. It uses a pagan myth to criticize two pagan worldviews. And one of the worldviews is rationalism. The other one is ritualistic mysticism. And these two worldviews were present in Lewis's day and very present in our day, too. And so Lewis also tries to demonstrate truths about the Christian worldview without taking the characters out of their pagan world. So we'll see that Lewis does this sort of thing all the time with characters. So out of all of C.S. Lewis's books, this one's probably been read the least. It's been many people's like least favorite books of his. And right after it was published, all of the book critics gave it a terrible review. So it never sold well. It never got a lot of traction. in C.S. Lewis's day. So it fell into obscurity, and it was only read by a few people. But Lewis, on the contrary, thought this was his best work. So I think we better pay attention to it if he thought it was his best. So it's probably pretty important. So let's talk about the main characters in the book. So we have two contrasting main characters, right? So who's the one character that we know about already? We probably know about both of these by now in reading.
Oriel?
It's Oriel. So who is Oriel? Well, she's a princess in this city called Gloam, which is a small kingdom close by, but it's not exactly a part of the Greek world. And Oriel is a good child who grows up in the castle, pretty much growing up unnoticed by everybody. So she's not a very noticeable girl. And actually, the book kind of describes her as being kind of ugly. So she's not very, like, attractive to look at. But her half-sister, Psyche, is very beautiful. And she's almost opposite Oriel in every way. Oriel's ugly, Psyche's beautiful. Everybody comes to love Psyche, and no one really even notices Oriel, right? So even Oriel comes to love Psyche, and she's beloved by everybody. And Psyche begins to display all these miraculous powers of healing as a plague and a famine comes through Gloam. Now, Oriel's obsession with Psyche and Psyche's abduction by the gods causes Oriel to write the first part of the book, which is what we're reading right now. And the other notable character in the book is the fox. It's Fox. He's a Greek slave, and he has been spared hard labor because him being a Greek means that he can instead be a tutor for the girls of the royal house instead of doing hard labor. And he loves the girls, and he loves especially Oriel and Psyche, and he represents Greek philosophy and its wisdom in this story. Okay? So the book is set in a fictional pre-Christian kingdom, somewhere on the outskirts of Greek influence. And it comes to us in two parts. The book is separated into two. The first part is Oriel's charge of guilt against the gods. And the second part of the book shows us Oriel's opinions of the events in the first part of the book and how they've been changed by some extraordinary events that happen. Okay? I'm not going to tell you much more about it because I don't want to give away the book. So, with that in mind, let's talk about the worldview with this book. So, this book is very complex and it's multi-layered. Your intro in Omnibus describes it like a cake. It's a good layer, you know. We don't really care for multi-layered and complicated things, usually. But whenever it's sweet dessert, we would prefer multi-layered and complex, right? Because that means it tastes better. Okay, so the author in the Omnibus intro describes his book with like being a complex cake with all these different fillings and icings and all these sorts of things, right? So for any of you who have baked a cake before, what ingredients do you need to make a basic cake?
Sugar, flour, eggs, milk.
Yeah. Butter. Yeah. Yeah, depending on the type of cake, obviously the other ingredients, the flavorful ingredients are going to vary. But yeah, anytime you make any sort of cake, you need those basic items. Eggs, flour, sugar, milk, oil, all those sorts of things, right? So we can do that. How many of us have baked a cake before?
Played
some kind of part. Yeah, you baked it. You took a part in it. Yeah. So, but if you want to make a superb cake like we see in those bake-off challenges on TV, you need a lot of other ingredients besides those things, right? Right. How many of y'all seen, like, those bake-off shows on TV where they just make the insane cakes?
Like a Christmas series, like when they do, like, the Christmas competitions?
Yeah.
Sometimes
you do the great baking shows. Mm-hmm. Right. So you need a lot more ingredients than just those things in order to make a crazy cake. Right? And also you need a baker who knows what they're doing, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, oftentimes some of these cakes, guys, are so tall, even wedding cakes, are so tall that How do they even stand up on their own? Well, they put like structures in them, and they put like wooden sticks and things in them to keep them up so they can go high. But you need a cook and you need a baker who knows what they're doing in order to do that, and to be able to move it in such a way as it doesn't tumble and fall apart, right? So we need a cook who knows how to do this stuff. And if we're comparing books to cakes, C.S. Lewis is probably one of the best bakers we could find. He's a very good writer, and he knows what he's doing with all these ingredients. And until we have faces, we have a lot of ingredients, we have a lot of layers, and he and C.S. Lewis really knows how to make these layers taste good, taste pleasing to us, right? And he takes all of these worldviews that are represented in the book, and he skillfully works all of them together to bring about a final product that makes his point in a masterful way. And the first layer of the cake is the worldview of the narrator, a rule in the first part of the book. Now, would we find that a rule's disposition is particularly sweet in the first half of the book? Not really, no. A rule, if we look at what she's saying, we can gain an understanding of how she understands God and or the gods in this case. And we can gain an understanding of her view of man, and we can understand her view of salvation. And are things looking really good in her viewpoint right now in the first half? Not really, no. She's bitter. She's angry. Because this layer, we can call it, represents the outlook of a rule, which is bitterness. And a rule is in a place where she knows very little about the true God, and she hates what she thinks she knows about the gods, and she knows nothing of the Trinity. The Trinity is not even anywhere near here in her mind, and she hates the gods that she knows about. Is this something really important question? Huh? Well, go ahead. So, for example, one goddess she really hates is the goddess Unget, and her religion, the religion of Unget, is the official religion of Glom. And Unget demands some really weird rituals, and she demands some sacrifices and prostitution, a lot like the gods in Gilgamesh. And there's also the god of the mountain, who also demands sacrifices. And this god both marries and devours his victims. So these are some pretty vicious gods. Right. And all of these savage and horrible gods leads Arul to reject any of the morals and laws that come from them. And she strikes out at them and she goes out on her own to find her own morals and to find her own ethics. She rejects the ethics and morals of the gods. And as a matter of fact, she'd rather define what's right and wrong on her own than to submit to these tyrannical gods. And as she deals with the loss of her sister, because the god of the mountain wanted Psyche and he took her, as she deals with this loss, she tries to justify her actions by writing an angry diatribe or an angry response and an angry charge against the gods. And so she condemns Unget and she condemns the god of the mountain for being selfish and daring to offend Arul's newly defined standard of morality. So the gods, in her mind, broke her own made-up laws. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So Unget, according to Arul, she says that Unget just takes so much from the people of Glom, and he never gives anything back to them in return. And she's made the young women of Glom old, frail women in her temple. And the other god, the god on the mountain, is unleashing a bunch of plagues on the people and is not giving anything back to them. And the ultimate sacrifice that the god of the mountain chose to take from Glom was Psyche, the most beautiful and the most perfect woman in Glom. And what makes it even worse is that the gods seem to make those that they are that they're taking almost willing to go and to be taken. So Psyche somehow intoxicated and tricked and manipulated Psyche to believe that it's good to go and be sacrificed. She wants to go and be sacrificed. Okay, and this intoxicating power makes Arul very angry. And she feels that Psyche has been stolen from her. And so there's a lot of bitterness in the first part of this book. And it gets even more complicated by the fact that communion and communication with the gods doesn't even seem certain. All right, when we pray to God, our God, we know He hears us, right? How do we know He hears us? How do we know we're just not speaking into thin air? Because then it says in the Bible, we have that guarantee in the Bible, and we have all the guarantees that have been set forth by Christ, that when we're in covenant with God, He hears our prayers. We have that. Arul didn't have that. She didn't have that guarantee. So she's not even completely knowing that for sure if the gods are even hearing her. And so, you know, the people of Glom, they don't have a Bible like we do to have these assurances. And although they try, they worship and try to please the gods, they don't really know the gods that they're trying to please. And this is true both of Ungud, who is worshipped through a huge shapeless rock. They worship, that's how they're worshipping this god. And also the god of the mountain, who both loves and eats sacrifices. So, sounds like some pretty terrible gods, if you ask me. Yes, it is kind of nasty. So, the gods are at least communicating a couple of things, though. The people do know that the god of the mountain is demanding a sacrifice. They know that, because the priests at least could figure that one out. And number two, the gods are calling some people to them. And this is seen in Psyche's willingness to go and be sacrificed to the god of the mountain. And so the ethics and the morality of this book is also really complicated. The great moral dilemma in this book occurs when Arul and Psyche meet each other on the mountain after their sacrifice. And as they talk to one another, they speak to one another, they both realize that they're living in two different worlds. Psyche believes she's living in a castle and that she's become the wife of a god. But Arul doesn't see the same thing that Psyche sees. Arul doesn't see a castle. And also, although she doesn't understand how Psyche could be so healthy and even more beautiful living all by herself in the woods, she thinks that Psyche's lost her mind. And that she's been abducted by some random person living in the mountains. And the disagreement really reaches a high point when Arul stabs herself and she threatens to hurt herself even more if Psyche doesn't stop trusting her husband and if Psyche doesn't light a lamp at night to discover her husband's identity. And so that night, Arul, as she's staring over in the direction of the palace, she catches a glimpse of the otherworldly home that Psyche sees. But in the end, Arul refuses to trust the god of the mountain, and that leads to Psyche's exile from her garden paradise. And Arul blames the gods for this because they didn't give her enough evidence. And so here's where we see C.S. Lewis really doing some fun things with his cake baking here. So through this dilemma, we see an antithesis. He's pushing an antithesis. Anybody remember what an antithesis is? I talked about this briefly last year. Actually, I talked about this quite a bit last year. An antithesis. It's basically what an antithesis is. It's the dividing point between right and wrong. It's a dividing point between light and darkness. It's a dividing point between two opposite sides. Okay, we have a thesis and we have an antithesis. So Lewis is really bringing out the antithesis, the difference between these two worldviews, between rationality or rationalism and relativistic mysticism. He's bringing out the antithesis here. And the way of life in the book is to trust the god of the mountain. And Psyche, out of her love for her sister, she disobeys her husband. You know, her husband, the god of the mountain, and then she finds herself sent away from the palace. So the god of the mountain sends her out because she disobeyed him. And then basically that means righteousness results from faith, which causes obedience. There's a lot of layers here, and I'm not expecting y'all to understand every single layer, because we could talk about this book all year and peel back the layers. But I just want you to get the gist of it, okay? And in the opposite of that, that side of things is sin. And it's a distrust of the gods and a rejection of the grace that's offered to them. And the second part of the book, the bitterness that Rural felt towards the gods is changed because she gets a clearer view of herself and of her love. And looking at Rural's view of herself helps us to understand her view of man as a whole. Okay? So first, she sees herself and her sister, and by extension, all men, as mistreated slaves of the gods. The gods are tyrannical. They just tell us what to do. They beat up on us. We have to do what they say, and they don't give us any blessings. Okay? We do our best as a people to try to appease the gods and please them and make them like us, but it's never enough. And the gods take out their anger on them. And so she sees people as good and gods as bad. That's the worldview that Arul has in the first half of the book. Okay? People good, gods bad. How does that square with Christianity? People good, gods bad. Landon?
It's the opposite.
Right, right. God, singular. God, good. People, bad. Yeah, it's totally opposite. But then things change in the latter part of the book. Arul's understanding begins to be transformed. And during the first part of the book, it seems like Arul is pursuing wisdom. And we seem to be, we're going to be on her side. And of course, she makes some mistakes along the way, but the mistakes seem to be justifiable. She loves her sister. She loves Psyche. And she loves Fox. And later on, she gets to rule the city of Gloam, and she rules wisely, and she displays courage in a duel with King Argon later on. But all of this is turned on its head in the second part of the book. Now, in the second part, we can see who she really is. She reveals who she is. The mask has been taken off of her. And her love of Psyche has not been a benevolent love, a love that's other-centered. She realized that her love of Psyche is actually a selfish love. These things are starting to change. The people aren't starting to be so good anymore. Now people are starting to be bad, as represented in herself. Okay? And so her love of Bardia is seen to be a devouring love. Her hatred of the gods is shown to be like the egotistical cries of a child who's in a fit and who demands everything in the world to bow to her will, like she's the center of the universe. And she's finally, she's standing in the courtroom of the dead, and she begins to see who she really is, and she repents of her folly. And later on, as Arul gets older, and she begins to understand herself as she really is, she realizes that she has become the very goddess that she hated. She becomes Unget, and all the evil that she has heaped upon the gods is really a picture of what she's like. And she even takes on the physical characteristics of Unget, being veiled all the time. You can go get that if you want. So, what Lewis is really doing here, now, how many of y'all understand the words I'm saying? Are y'all tracking with me? Kind of, sort of? I understand that. It's hard for me to lecture on this book because it's super complicated. So I'm doing the best I can. So what Lewis is really doing is the most, if you don't get anything else from this lecture, get this. Lewis is posing a question to us. And it's generally the same question that Gilgamesh gives to us, okay? Which is why you're reading these books together. There's a reason for this. And the question is this. Is there salvation outside of Christ? Is there salvation outside of the church? You remember, in Gilgamesh, the people are beginning to look for salvation in who? In Gilgamesh. But we're going to see how many times Gilgamesh tries to be a savior and fails. That's because he is a man. He's not the God-man like Jesus Christ. He's a false Messiah. Two-thirds God, lowercase g, and one-third man. So he fails. He's not truly God and truly man. He's this weird pseudo-savior, pseudo-God-man. Okay, so we're going to see how that fails. The same thing with till we have faces. We're going to answer the question, is there salvation outside of Christ? Is there salvation outside of the Trinitarian God? Okay. And while the answer to this question we have to realize that Lewis is telling a story about the ancient pre-Christian past, just like Gilgamesh is. And so during this time, it's clear through examples, like with Jethro and Melchizedek in the Bible, that remembrances and evidences of the gospel did come about and resound at times. Y'all remember Melchizedek? When did Melchizedek appear in the Bible? Y'all just read this like a couple weeks ago. What book of the Bible is Melchizedek in? Genesis. Genesis, exactly. Good job. Yeah. Who makes sacrifices and offerings to Melchizedek? Abraham. Okay, very good, guys. Very good. Good reading. Yeah, so we can see, and the author of Hebrews makes that comparison of the priest that Melchizedek is to Christ. So we can see that there are types and shadows and remembrances of the Gospels in those ancient cultures. Remember, Abraham was alive around the time that Gilgamesh was still a very popular story. And the gods that were being worshipped of the city of Ur were still being worshipped. So we have a different priest in Melchizedek, a priest that signifies and points to Jesus Christ. So we have those things in those ancient cultures. And also, we have to understand, too, to answer this question of salvation outside of Christ, we have to understand that Lewis, in this case, is not contemplating salvation outside of Christ, okay? But that the true God chose in this story to reveal himself to two sisters who live far outside of the perimeter of his promises, okay? Now, Lewis has been charged over the years, in this book and in Narnia, with opening the gate of salvation wider than the gospel allows it to be open. Okay, how many of you remember in the last battle in Narnia? I'm sure all of y'all have read Narnia already.
I read everything.
But the last battle. All right. Well, in the last battle, I'll give you a little preview. In the last battle, C.S. Lewis shows a sincere worshiper of the false god Tosh. Remember Tosh? He's a false god. But the sincere worshiper of Tosh gets accepted by Aslan. Y'all remember this? Those who have read it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's worshiping Tosh. He's not worshiping Aslan, but his heart's in the right place and he's sincere. So Aslan accepted him as a worshiper of him. Right? With that, does that sound kind of weird to you?
Yes.
It's like, well, that means that we can worship Allah, like Islam's God, but if we're sincere and we really mean it in our hearts to worship Him, it's like we're really worshiping Jesus? That's not right. So, a lot of people have accused Lewis of being believing universalism, which is the idea that it doesn't really matter which God you believe, all roads lead to the same God. Y'all can see how that's a heresy, right? That's a huge heresy. And many people have accused Lewis of being that way, that saying that he believes in the end everybody will be saved and no one will ultimately be damned. But I don't think he's doing that, though. Yes, sir? Sure. I don't think he's doing that, though, because there's plenty of evidence in Lewis's writings that he's not a universalist. But I think in the case of Psyche and Arul, the true God has already chosen to reveal himself to these two, and in the end, redeemed them and made them ready for heaven. So Arul's description of this is not put in the familiar Christian language that we're all used to. But her descriptions do give us a clear picture of repentance and of salvation. And it also gives us a clear picture of the beatific vision, where humans get a face-to-face view of the glory of God. Okay? So, and no matter how skilled C.S. Lewis is in writing or in cooking, if we want to keep that analogy going, we have to judge whether Lewis is justified in presenting a gospel, a picture of the gospel disguised in pagan clothes. Okay? So, in order to do that, is he a universalist or not? So in order to understand why Lewis did this, I don't believe he is. So we need to figure out why he decided to do things like that. Well, we have to understand, one, Lewis's purpose. Why did he choose to picture the gospel this way? Number two, we have to understand it within the structure of the book. And three, we have to understand his shrewdness in doing it. Like, why is he doing it this way? So in the first part of the book, Arul's complaint against the gods, Lewis helps the reader to see the world through the lens of Arul's worldview. And you're going to see that as you read it. So you being the reader, if you're sympathetic with her, you're going to learn to hate the gods just like Arul does. Okay, but by the end of the book, your opinion should have made a 180-degree turn. And the reader finds out that Arul, like Arul, they didn't know what they were talking about in the beginning. For many readers, this 180-degree turn is disorienting because they thought they understood this story during the first half of the book. But as they read the second half, they realized they didn't have a grip on the situation at all. And that dizziness is all on purpose by Lewis. That's all orchestrated by him on purpose. And that's what the skill of a great writer does. He has all these twists and turns like a roller coaster trying to get you disoriented. Okay, so it's a sense Lewis crawls into pagan skin and tells a story full of pagan religions, which in the end demonstrate just how far short paganism really comes in light of true salvation and deliverance in Christ. And so we'll see that as we read it. It does the same exact thing that the Epic of Gilgamesh does. The only real difference between Gilgamesh and this is, well, there's not too many differences of the points of the book. We're going to see just how far short the gods of Gilgamesh are, and the god of the mountain and Ungit is in C.S. Lewis's Till We Have Faces, because those are the same gods. C.S. Lewis is meaning to write about gods that are the exact gods that are in the same lineup with Gilgamesh. Okay, so they're talking about the same time period. And so we'll really see as we read the book how much our God is better and our gospel is better. It's actually a gospel of good news.